funk.
To SERFM, bringing you back to funk for 40 years. Let's celebrate.
If you got that feeling, got that funky feeling, if you got that feeling, get up out your seat. If you got that feeling, got that funky feeling, if you got that feeling, get up, move your feet.
Welcome to the Back to Funk 40th birthday marathon here on 2SER 107.3. My name is DJ Meme, and this is a very, very special radio event which is going to carry on for hours and hours on this Saturday afternoon. Kicking off now from midday, we've got so much in store. We've got lots of past presenters from the program over the 40-year history, including John Potts, Stuart Coop, Brent Clough, Heidi Pasquale, Peter Pasquale, Gordon Henderson, Tim Ritchie and Miguel D'Souza. I've caught up with so many past presenters to chat about their time throughout the station and their involvement in the Back to Funk radio show. We've also got an exclusive special guest mix from Lance Ferguson from the Bamboos, and also a whole host of 2SER DJs and friends who are jumping on board to play a mix in celebration of 40 years of Back to Funk. We're going to be hearing music from Shan Frenzy, Paris Groove Scooter, DJ Soup, Hoba Mallow, Trevor Parkey, Boo Boo Muck, Del Piero, Blaze, and Sophie Lozoyo. So much in store on today's very special broadcast celebrating 40 years of the Back to Funk radio show. We're going to kick off now with a little bit of music before we get into some of the history of the show. Wonderful to have your company on this very special radio event. We'll be right back. are tuned in to the Back to Funk 40th Birthday Marathon Show here on 2SER 107.3. My name is DJ Meme, current caretaker of Back to Funk. I'm in about my 17th year on the show, but the show itself has a much longer history, being on air from 1980. But about 7 years ago, I went back to many of the past presenters and had a chat to them to talk about some of the history of the show. I'm going to replay that particular recording because it's a great outline of some of the things that happened over the course of the years throughout Back to Funk and some of the great voices and presenters that we've heard over the years. So let's take a listen now to the history of the Back to Funk radio show.
Hi, I'm John Potts. They say that I'm the godfather of Back to Funk because I seem to have started it back in 1980.
John Potts, the founder of the Back to Funk radio show, was the first in a succession of DJs and music enthusiasts to host what has now become Australia's longest-running funk music show. I tracked down many of the past presenters of the program, including John, to look back into the roots and history of Back to Funk since it began way back in 1980.
Okay, I started as a volunteer radio producer at 2SER in 1980. The main show that I did at the time was called 3600 Seconds, which ran for a long time on a Saturday and had we were playing soul music on it. But I also produced a number of other music and kind of educational shows, one of which was called From Punk to Funk. And it was an attempt to bridge the music that was thought to be most interesting and cutting edge for young people at the time, which was kind of post-punk, new wave rock music, which was still very kind of current in about 1980. But also increasingly people were getting more interested in dance music or rhythm, blues, soul music or funk. And so this program was thought to be a crossover, any possible connections between punk and funk. And that ran for a while until I, like many people at the time, became more interested in the funk side of it and less interested in the rock or new wave or punk side of it. So it mutated into a show called Back to Funk.
A few years later, Back to Funk was then handed over to Brent Clough.
Well, my reason for getting involved was that I had John as a tutor, I think, at university. And, you know, we talked about funk a lot and soul. Interestingly, at that time, in the mid-80s, there wasn't so many people into black music. There were very few black music shows. So John and I used to talk about music, and he was doing the show, and he, I think, just wanted to pass it on because he was getting busy with work and life and so on. And I was a record, you know, deranged student. So because I think hip-hop was just arriving and there hadn't been a history of black music, particularly in this country, I came from New Zealand, it struck me here that there was a lot of music lying around, but people weren't valuing it much. I remember going around with Rob Milton, the Rare Groove guy from London, and we just went to dozens of secondhand stores and walked away with crates of great 70s funk that no one wanted. You know, it was a weird time because it wasn't fetishized like it is now. And in fact, people used to think dance music was new order, and, you know, they didn't really think about black music particularly in a lot of ways, even at dance parties. That's my memory of it.
Initially, there was a bit of a kind of standoff between the independent rock, kind of punk new wave sensibility and the African-American one. So you had to be a purist, either one or the other. However, increasingly, people like me started to get bored with that and started to like both. And probably as the 80s went on, we started to tilt more and more over to contemporary R&B. So there are a lot of good record shops, or this was just the dawn of the age of the CD, but we still played records at the time. And we actually had an agreement with one of them, which was Anthem Records, which was one of the best ones in the city. So every Friday when I'd do this show, I would get the latest batch of funk or R&B records from Anthem and play them. So that was largely the source. They would actually, probably a brief plug at the end, they would give us the latest batch of records that came straight from the States.
Yeah.
So increasingly, we were more interested in R&B and funk music than rock music, which started to seem a little stale by the end of the 80s.
But black music was clubland in Rockdale. It was like out in the subs where there'd be people like Rodney O playing funk and soul. That's my memory arriving here in 83 from New Zealand. But the only place I heard really good funk and soul selections were in clubs in Rockdale and La Kemba and places like that, you know.
In the mid-80s, young Heidi Pasquale joined the Back to Funk team.
Well, I came to the show, I think, from a bit further out. When I was in high school, I lived in Tamworth, country music capital, and my friends and I would tell our parents we were staying at each other's places, catch the train, the overnight train, and if you think of Red Rattler's Bad, the old trains that came from Tamworth to Sydney that took 10-plus hours... We'd hop on the train Friday night, arrive in Sydney on the Saturday. We'd go shopping at Disco City, Licorice Pizza, Anthem, and then we would go out clubbing. And in those days, these are the late 70s, the only clubs that played dance music were gay clubs. So I was a teenage fag hag. So we'd come down on the train, go shopping all day, buy records, go out dancing all night, crash at somebody's place on the Sunday, and then catch the train home Sunday night and go back to Tamworth High School Monday morning with, you know, our little stack of records. My compatriot David, who lived across the road, we would both push our speakers to the front windows, open the windows, put on the latest disco record, turn the volume up, ring the other person and say, "Listen to this," hang the phone up, turn the volume up and listen to our sound systems across the road. Then I did a couple of different jobs when I moved to Sydney. I ended up working at Disco City. I got a radio show while I was there. I got a radio show on Radio Eastern Sydney, and that was called Black Plastic. I had this little show and it became very, very popular. And from as soon as school finished in the afternoons, phone calls would start coming in, letters were coming in with requests, and I'd go out looking for the music and putting together this show. And that proved to be an unwise move because it wasn't very popular with the station, and I got thrown off that station. And I'd been listening to Back to Funk on 2SER, and I became a volunteer at 2SER, and then my dreams came true and I was introduced to Brent and Mark Carey.
That's right, yeah.
You guys were doing the show at the time, and you guys were so kind and took me in and sort of showed me how to use the gear and were really, really encouraging. And so, to me, soul music and dance music had a very inclusive sort of feel to it. Because it was with friends that I saw it, with friends that I learned about it, became friends with you guys and you took me under your wing. And so that was how I came to SER, from being thrown off another station. When I worked at Disco City at that time, the zeitgeist with the record companies was dance music is only for blacks and gays.
That's it.
That was the quote.
And the only, you're right, the only city clubs that were really going near dance music, and it would have been more of disco, were gay clubs. Mm. But, you know, brilliant DJs too, like Stephen Hawkins, who was probably the greatest funk DJ ever in Sydney, and still is, I think, you know, still plays. And he really knew the music. He knew the depths of it right into the, you know, mid-70s, and Tom Moulton and all the extent. You know, he just knew disco and funk inside out.
Yeah.
He's a great historian of it. But I remember when they came and told me that, oh, there's this girl who's going to come in and wants to be on the program. We were kind of like, oh, right, so who's this? Some work experience, you know. Going to have to look after her and, you know, explain music. Totally, you know, patriarchal, patronising sort of approach. But you turned up and, you know, you already had this massive knowledge and this huge collection of music, and we were suddenly going, oh, right. So, and we were learning stuff from you pretty quickly too. And I remember going through your records one day at your place and just going, my God, this woman's serious. It was
this
great.
Woman needs to get a life.
This woman knows disco like a gay DJ.
Well, it's funny you say that, because I've always said that you can tell so much about a person by their record collection, and everybody would think I was a middle-aged gay guy with the amount of dollars
from Manhattan. Or something.
Yeah.
Yeah, so but I seem to recall too, once you arrived, that kind of inaugurated a new period on Back to Funk where a lot of hip hop started happening. And I seem to remember we had a lot of kind of people involved in the local beginnings of hip hop really kind of coming, because it was one of the few places that was playing hip hop alongside funk and disco. There were all sorts of people who were just starting to express themselves locally in hip hop, and it was a kind of exciting time really, because it was brand new and interesting.
And I think the thing with all of us was that it I don't know about you guys, but I got the vibe from everybody else that we felt it was a privilege to be involved in the music. It was about the music and discovering something and finding out that so-and-so sampled this, or this really should be sampled, and putting everything together and finding out where the music came from and what it was about was such a joy for us, that there was no such thing as going home and programming your set. You spent your whole life programming sets, your whole life discovering things, and it sort of brought us together. I met the person who became my husband for 20 years, Peter Pasquale. I met him in Disco City. After I'd been doing the show 4 years, and there was a guy called Robbie Savellis had come onto the show, and he invited Pete to come on the show, and then Pete became friends with Gordon.
Yes, I've been listening to Back to Funk for probably since at least 87, I'd say, and my whole introduction to 2SER was just tuning around the dial late one night, and I came across a show, I think it was called Madhouse, and just hearing those sounds, it was so different to anything I'd ever heard before, and it made me really want to explore all the other sort of music that was on. And so I'd been listening to Back to Funk for ages, and eventually got a job doing a DJing, and so I was shopping for my records and buying my records from Pete, but I didn't know that Pete was the one who was on Back to Funk, so that was my connection there.
Say hello to Pete Pasquale.
I remember listening to it in my early teens, just thinking, wow, this music's fantastic. So it was Brent and Mark first, and then Heidi joined. And that's when I used to listen to the show initially. And I used to go back and forth listening to, you know, Back to Funk 1 week, Tim Ritchie's Dance, Dance, Dance another, which was, you know, the show to listen to on Triple J. But those were the only real shows that you could listen to for that style of music. But it was always ad hoc. It was always on the fly. And we loved our family, you know. I mean, that's SER, you know, at the end of the day is a family. It's, you know the people that work here, you know, and you've known them for years, and they've been here for years. And I think that's why the radio station works so well, because it's not a pretentious radio station. The shows aren't pretentious, and we're basically here for each other. So back in the day when people used to pop in, it was just basically like your best friends coming in, you know.
One of the many best friends of the show was Tim Ritchie, who presented a regular segment called Future Funk.
So in 1990, Triple J and I parted company, and it wasn't the happiest of times for me. And Heidi and Pete said, oh, we still think you have a place on the radio. So Back to Funk was the program, and they said, why don't you come on and do a segment? And I said, oh, well, I know a bit about where music is sort of going, so let's do a thing called Future Funk. And so I did, and I came on, I think it was once a fortnight for some years. It helps that Back to Funk has always had nice people. Like, that sounds really, you know, pissy expression, nice people. But people who are passionate about what they particularly like, and they're also passionate that others are allowed to like their own stuff, and there could be crossover. But Heidi is one of the most positive people that I've ever met, and the fact that you're there, like bothering to take out of your time half an hour, nothing, for me to walk across the road from work to SER, she'd always be there, arms open, tell me what you've got. It was a family kind of thing, and I'm sure that if anyone becomes, you know, comes close to being part of the action of Back to Funk, you feel that family thing.
The family extended out to many people. one of whom was presenter Miguel D'Souza.
With Back to Funk specifically, I think we all had different pathways into that community that was formed around that show. I'm not even sure at the time that I was there I could have named everybody who had been involved with the show. I mean, I knew Peter and Heidi and Gordon, and I knew this massive posse of people that floated in and out of that studio. And the thing was, I think to me it was a few things. It was, firstly, everybody had a different pathway in, but everybody was welcome and always was. And I think that the music was fantastic, and Brent has talked to me, has just defined it for me. You know, the sheer depth of that music meant that everybody could have their own little space in it and could share that part of it and could share a story or could share the music. And there was a lot of sharing going on. You know, everybody also had this interest in sharing the music. It was all about making sure people heard, because all they had to do was hear it and people would realise how good this was. I lost count of how many times you had that sense. I mean, I clearly remember the night when, playing at Kinsella's, somebody walked up to me, it was about 1990, and said, "Take this nigger music off." And it was interesting because, you know, 20 years later, yeah, that's gone. I mean, black music is popular music. You know, it's, I still rub my eyes and go, Jay-Z's the world's biggest star, Kanye West is the world's biggest star. These are hip-hop artists, and they're making what sounds to me like real hip-hop, you know. And it's, in a sense, that feeling, that kind of intensity of feeling for that music, as really expressed by these different pathways people had, and people owned this different chunk of this massive music and this massive culture and shared it with people who were just as passionate and who felt like their mission was to just get as many people as possible to hear it, and then they would realise how damn good it was. It was this binding kind of force.
You know, we kind of had a free rein on what we played, and we weren't genre specific. Yeah. We tried our best not to discriminate against styles of music, because at the end of the day, the whole reasoning and the whole idea about Back to Funk was that you could eventually, you know, go out 50 miles from where you were and still come back to the one, which is the whole sort of funk concept. So Back to Funk really was all about playing whatever you felt like, as long as you brought it back to funk. That was the whole idea of it. So the show then sort of encompassed hip-hop, we played house, we played funk, soul, jazz, reggae. It was a mixed bag, but it kind of worked. I don't know how it did, but yeah, it kind of did work.
I think that's something people forget about the 80s too, actually, that it was this moment when lots of different streams were all kind of flowing into the, you know, into the kind of same stream, and they were, you know, connecting up. I mean, disco and hip-hop were obviously connected, but people now don't want to acknowledge that disco and hip-hop were well connected. And then house sort of came as we were kind of looking at funk and hip-hop. There's house kind of emerging as another sort of stream from disco. And, you know, there was so many connections, and yet, you know, it was easier to do it in those days, I think. I think things became more segregated as they went along, and, you know, and genres became more established and people defined differences more.
And what SER managed to do, because SER didn't have to play by any rules, I mean, there are rules, but they could, enthusiasts could find music that they thought was good. So something like SER was a place where you could just by chance come across a show that was playing music you'd not heard before, even though that music may be from the 60s, you were still finding new things. And it was avenues like that where stations don't have to have a set format that is the homogenous way of which we all are told that's how you'll be successful. How do you measure success? I measure success by making a difference in people's lives, and SER did and does.
You know, if you go back and look at the way history is, there was no other way except for watching TV that you were able to listen to the style of music. You know what I mean? You know, I'm not talking pre-electricity here, but I'm talking pre-internet. And, you know, there was just, you listen to programs like Back to Funk or radio stations like 2SER because you wanted to know what was going on the weekends. You wanted to know who was DJing where. You wanted to be part of the community. And I think that's basically how people discovered each other, and radio was so integral, you know. You went to gigs because you were part of that community, you listened to that radio station, and you listened to those shows, and those shows put on gigs, and et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I think it was part of people's path, you know. It was a very important path.
Do you know something that actually also struck me at the time was that because of the fact that there were only a couple of shows, and almost all of them on community radio on 2SER, playing this sort of music, when some of these people toured here, you know, they were avoiding completely mainstream radio stations, you know, and I can't understate that enough, because to me, I've learned everything I've learned about, you know, what marketing people call viral stuff from that period. Yeah. I go when, you know, if I want inspiration for something that works on the internet, I go back to then and I think, how did it spread then? My best training ground for understanding fundamentally how the internet works was community radio, and even better than that was Back to Funk, because of the fact that it was one radio show which lasted for 2 hours once a week, and everybody that I knew that I wanted to hang out with knew about it and knew something about it, and that to me is to me that was the first viral media was community radio, and I maybe I'm overstating it, I'm not sure, but you know, to me, you know, community radio in general, and to me in the early 80s was in the 80s and into the 90s was the first viral media that really spread around without any obvious kind of motivation, any obvious money. It was all pushed on by enthusiasm and a hell of a lot of knowledge. And passion.
We didn't really have an agenda. We didn't have a plan. It was just stuff that we did. It just happened. And I remember somebody asking me when Brent and Mark took me in for Back to Funk, they were saying, oh, what's this show like? And I just went, it's really irreverent. These guys just play brilliant music and it's irreverent and it's just fun. And no matter what we were doing, we all just had fun, not just in the studio, but out of the studio as well. That was our Fridays were our life, weren't they?
Yeah, it was the way to get into the weekend. You know, that was always the thing about the show. It was the great, you know, best way to start your weekend.
Back to Funk has been credited as one of the first shows to really embrace early hip-hop culture in Sydney. So I was interested to find out firstly about the emergence of graffiti artists and also what role Back to Funk played in assisting the birth of the local hip-hop community.
Well, like most things in my life, it seemed like a good idea at the time. It was just, this was happening. It was so intensely interesting and there was so much life in it, and it was a real game changer. It just seemed perfectly natural to talk about it and to ask the artists about what they were doing. There was no concept that, oh, this is a subculture we should explore. It was just like, this is cool, let's do it. I've since heard from other people that it was a really good thing that it happened at the time, because there were so many talented artists coming up, and it ratified the movement, the fact that somebody in one suburb could be into a style of music, into a style of art, into a style of dance, into a style of production, and find out that they weren't the only one. You know, we were, I suppose we were finding our people. It just seemed like a good idea at the time, and I really felt compelled to find out about it and look into it. I mean, later on, record companies started to realise that there could be some value in exploring these avenues. But I was fortunate enough to meet people who were brilliant artists, and no matter how raw or accomplished they were, with the things that they were doing, they were expressing themselves. And the thing that really, really touched me, that I've taken with me in my entire life. You know, week by week I think about this. The saying that we used to have in the hip-hop scene, in all of the elements, was a blank wall equals a blank mind. We are responsible for our environment. If we do not like our environment, we have the power, we have the authority, we have the courage to change it and to beautify it. So no matter where you find yourself in life, you can make it more beautiful. And that may sound a bit whack, you know, looking back on the 80s of, hey, there's a blank wall, let's paint it. But it's a wonderful way to live life, to go, well, here I am. What do I want to see? What do I want to hear? What do I want to feel?
It's a great shame that that scene wasn't maybe documented as well as it should have been, and because it was a very rich scene. It was, you know, interesting on all sorts of levels, musically and sociologically and so on. But I think we do look back at that time as a kind of moment when there was a lot going on. There seemed to be a lot going on around the place. But I remember it also being a really kind of roughneck scene. In fact, I stopped being actively interested in supporting the hip-hop scene after getting a chair broken over my head at the Paddington Town Hall and being actually kind of rescued from a very serious fight. And it was a kind of, it was a sketchy scene in a lot of ways. There was a lot of little hoodlums involved.
Well, it was easier for us. It certainly wasn't easy for kids who were putting down some cardboard or a sheet of lino outside Hoyt's and being mocked and jeered because they were breakdancing. And, I mean, kids would... dancers would go where they could find a PowerPoint. So your B-boys and B-girls were in public spaces representing, but it was not appreciated.
I always thought that there's a PowerPoint on one of those pylons at Circular Quay that is responsible for hip-hop as a mass movement in Sydney, because he tells me that they basically, as you said, you just mentioned the live power thing. I think it was Circular Quay where they first found a PowerPoint and they plugged in either a boombox or a set of turntables, I'm not sure, and had one of their first kind of, you know, breakdancing events. And again, this is before the internet, this is before text messaging and social media and all of that sort of stuff. And they were getting crowds of up to a few hundred. But it always amazed me how... what a lot of these kids did was spontaneously sort of gather, seemingly spontaneously, without any apparent sort of sense of organisation. I think shows like Back to Funk, well, I know shows like Back to Funk were critical in sort of starting to spread that word and certainly spread that enthusiasm.
But it was because of the form of music that people were interested in, which itself was always, I mean, you know, it was the ghetto newspaper. That idea, I still don't think, has gone away from black culture in so many ways. It's still crucial. And I think so much of the interesting aspects of what pop music's become has been tied to that alternative media that's come through, particularly from black music. You know, it was music that at that moment too was revolutionary, because we were in that moment moving from the analog to the digital, and it was that music that was dealing with it in the most experimental way. I think that's why someone like Lyndon Barber used to do a show which he would mix up industrial and rock music, but always with the kind of most experimental funk that was going on, because that was where the cutting edge was. And, you know, in so many ways, I think it takes us to where we are now, because it was the kind of model for sampling. Sampling was suddenly, as we were doing that program, sampling was really being turned into a craft. And the possibility of the archive as this huge resource, which we already knew through our enthusiasm, but it was becoming a tool in music making as well. And I mean, I actually think we watched a lot of that. I know I felt that from kind of 84 onwards.
I'd worked in my uncle's record store for years and hadn't realised that those are the things that these guys were playing, and they're the original tracks that hip-hop producers were sampling to come up with their songs. So really, Back to Funk was an education for me back in the day, and it was the thing that really taught me something about music.
Music is a physical existence. Music is vibration, and we are physically affected by the vibration. I know technically light is a finer vibration, and that's what we see is the light vibration. But with music, because it is such a physical response, you can respond beyond your senses, beyond your temporal perception. You can have an immediate and unique communication, and I think that you can have a very exact communication because that vibration will make you have an emotional response. So the listener has an artistic responsibility and an artistic talent in hearing music and taking it in as much as the creator. I think because music is such an immediate and perfect communicator of emotion, that is why we all have some sort of music that we like.
I just closed my eyes and had a flashback to a Friday afternoon maybe 25 years ago. I first heard that maybe 20 years ago on Back to Funk. And again, it's just makes me feel fantastic listening to that because it was all of that. You know, everybody had their theory.
When Heidi, Peter and Gordon handed over Back to Funk to myself, Meme, in 2004, I'd been listening to the show for many years and had come to know the closing phrase, peace and love. I asked Tim Ritchie about the meaning behind this long-standing tradition of closing the Back to Funk program with the phrase, peace and love.
I only remember hearing Heidi saying it and Pete saying it every time the show finished, so I think they genuinely believed that both of those things really positive things that can make your life easier. And it's easy to say peace and love, it's harder to live them, and they did. And the show sort of does, and it's about, you know, positivity without being cult-like in any way. It's just about... this is sounding really crappy. I've got a kid, my 10-year-old daughter, and every day of her life I've told her I love her. And it's just something when you can say that to someone, it means something. And so being able to introduce that into general expression on the radio, be able to say peace and love and mean it, that's good.
Yeah, yeah.
Funk is the universal language, and you can put on a piece of funk and you get the heads nodding and the rhythm going, and it's about a feeling, not just a sound. And with it comes, this sounds like crap to me, but I think it's the less precious about it, and it creates its own little micro community that is positive. It's all about peace and love.
While carrying out these interviews, I couldn't help but asking John Potts if, after starting the show way back in 1980, if he ever thought that it would last this long.
No, because things just started and closed pretty quickly. So I'm very glad that it's still been going, and I'd just like to thank and congratulate all the people who came after me for keeping the spirit going.
It was a privilege to be with you guys, and thank you.
You are tuned to the Back to Funk 40th birthday marathon here on 2SER 107.3 FM. We'll be right back. You're listening to the Back to Funk 40th birthday marathon here on 2SCR 107.3 FM. Going right back to the very beginnings of the show, from when it was named From Punk to Funk, I caught up with the founder of the show, John Potts, to have a further chat about his time and experience in the early days of 2SCR.
Well, in 1980, I just started as a student in communications at UTS. It was a fairly new course, and we were all encouraged to get experience in the media. So I was very interested in radio and was studying radio, and we could just go upstairs to 2SCR, which was on the 26th floor of the UTS Tower building, which is where we all were, and volunteered to work on a number of shows. So I was a volunteer producer getting practice on radio in a number of shows, and one of those was From Punk to Funk. And Stuart Coop was the announcer and was working on it, and I was producer on it. And I remember at that stage I used to want to like taking a bit of a historical focus, so doing short radio feature pieces on genres or whatever. So we did a lot of punk and new wave, but I started to get more interested in funk music. I remember doing a feature on Funkadelic and George Clinton in Parliament, and also about space funk, that whole idea of sci-fi space iconography around a lot of, like, say, the George Clinton type funk of the time, which also went back to jazz musicians like Sun Ra, who had a similarly extraterrestrial kind of space funk, imagery. And I remember then getting interested from doing those historical features on From Punk to Funk in funk music, or R&B and soul music more generally. And at one stage, I must have changed the show or created a new show called Back to Funk. Stopped playing the punk new wave rock music and just focused on funk music, especially the contemporary music. One of the reasons I remember doing that is around that time I noticed a lot of people who were interested in independent pop music had more of an interest in funk music. There were old punk bands like The Pop Group that started to dabble in funk, and people got more and more interested in it. This was at the same time as hip-hop was taking off, early 80s. And a lot of the musicians I knew, like the guys in the Rock Melons, which was a kind of a dance band, electronic dance band in Sydney, were very interested in the funk music of people, contemporary people like Zapp. I remember Zapp being very popular, and Roger Troutman, and they used vocoder and electronic treatment of their voices and synthesizers to a kind of funk beat. So we started to specialise in that kind of music, tried to keep up the historical focus by playing a lot of 70s stuff, but then more and more getting interested in music that was being produced in the 80s, which I suppose increasingly was using digital technology.
Yeah, it was a pretty exciting time in terms of production, what was happening in the 80s.
Yeah, well, from about 1982, I think you start to get MIDI and people using samplers a lot more, and drum machines, obviously, synthesizers and sequencers. People like Jimmy Jam and Terry Lewis, I remember, from Minneapolis, and Prince, of course, were able to use that technology in a very effective way.
So From Punk to Funk started in 1980. The station itself, 2SCR, started in 79. So it's almost, the show's almost as old as the station itself.
Yes.
Do you have any memories of, you know, what the sort of forming station was like in those early days?
I had a great sense of community, and a lot of people listened to it because it was... I think it had an educational license, it probably still does, but it was understood as like a community station with an interest in independent rock music, funk music. We also used to do a lot of promotion of any musical events or other events. I had another show with Virginia Madsen called 3600 Seconds. That was on Saturday morning. That was very long running, and we used to bring in anyone that was putting on any events like dance parties or big music concerts or kind of cabaret type things. So we use it to promote musicians and musical acts that were coming through. And I remember, for some reason, we used to be able to get access to the biggest kind of independent rock groups that were coming through. I remember The Cure being up in the studio at one stage, and Robert, Robert Smith being interviewed. I remember interviewing The Fall and Marquis Smith, and people used to just come up to our studios, even though it was just a tiny little community station that was largely run by students. People didn't seem to mind. They just seemed to have quite a good exposure to the music scene at the time.
Well, I think during this period, pre-internet, the radio played really a vital role in informing and educating people of what was on in that particular city.
That's right.
How do you feel like radio, like the role of radio has changed over 40 years? Mm-hmm. How do you see radio now in 2020 as opposed to the role it played back when you started?
Well, one thing, radio is a great survivor. People have been trying to write it off for a long time, ever since television came in. People were saying no one's going to listen to radio anymore, and of course they do. They listen more than ever. And when digital and streaming came in, people said, well, that's the end for broadcast radio. But of course it's not. People listen to more radio than ever, because you can listen to any station from around the world streaming, and people still listen to radio an awful lot in their cars, at home, where they work. It's pretty much ubiquitous, and it's been able to adapt to new technologies and new conditions of people's lifestyle better than any other medium, probably.
Mm. Now, you mentioned that during that time you were interviewing a lot of big names coming through. Yeah. Obviously a lot of overseas artists had a lot of value in being able to come on local community radio, because they knew they could reach that audience.
That's
really
right.
Do you have many memories of the sort of cultural fabric of Sydney at that time, and what was going on in Sydney in the 80s?
Well, anyone who's that old who was around that time will tell you it was vastly different, because there were so many live venues. Mm. They were everywhere, and it was cheap. If you like dance or funk music, they had lots of nightclubs where $3 will get you in the door for the whole night. Mm. And the big dance parties started at that time, like at Paddington Town Hall, and they were cheap. And there was music on everywhere that was cheap. So this was before a lot of the venues started to close down and convert their music rooms into pokies.
Mm. I just want to bring it back to radio again. Just wondering what your take is on what the importance of community radio, and in particular specialist music shows, are for the listening audience.
Well, they have a great deal of importance, because listeners know they're going to get shows with integrity, that they're not going to be selling out for trying to flog some kind of product, or they're not going to have product placement, or trying to promote inferior product because they have to. People are going to be making programs out of their own passion and interest in that kind of musical genre, if it's funk or rock or whatever, and they're going to have a specialist knowledge in it, and you have a faith in the producers and of that show that they know what they're talking about, and they're going to be bringing you the music that they think is the most interesting that people should hear.
John Potts there, the founder of the Back to Funk radio show from way back in the beginning when it was titled From Punk to Funk, who did present alongside Stuart Coop, who you might recognise from Dirt Music here on 2STR, still going strong on the station from the early beginnings right up to 2020 now. I caught up with Stuart to chat about his time and recollections of the early days of Back to Funk. We'll get to Stuart in a little bit, after a little bit more music here on 2STR 107.3 on the Back to Funk 40th Birthday Marathon Show.